Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shape us, now out in paperback. Firstly, this week, I want to say a huge, huge thank you. I've just announced the secret that I've been keeping for 6 months. In spring 2021, Sphere will be publishing my debut novel, Insatiable, the story of Violet, snarky, vulnerable, and desperate for an adventure, and how she experiences and embraces desire in all its messy, contradictory, selfish, challenging glory. I was absolutely overwhelmed in the loveliest way by your support on social media when we made the announcement. It felt better than a birthday, so thank you so much. I'm really excited to be sharing more with you about Insatiable when we get nearer to the publication date. And I want you all to be the first to get any news about it and any bonus material. So we've launched a Your Booked extension pack, Further Reading. It's a newsletter for fans of the podcast and fans of writing and reading. You can expect essays inspired by books I've loved. Imagine something between the LRB and the Beano, as well as book reviews and bonus episodes and special treats for subscribers. At the moment, it's completely free. In the future, you'll have the chance to purchase a premium subscription, and that will give you access to our book club, the Creative Career Clinic, which is going to be a well of great advice and handholding, as well as special events and giveaways. You can find out more at furtherreading.substack.com. Now onto our episode. For our fifth series of Your Booked, we're in the USA. Today we're in Brooklyn with Modern Love alumnus Ada Calhoun, whose latest book, Why We Can't Sleep, Women's New Midlife Crisis, became an instant New York Times bestseller. Ada's book, Wedding Toast I'll Never Give, is one of my all-time favourites. You might remember it being a steal of the week a few series ago. And this is one of my favourite episodes ever, mainly because Ada produced a Barbara Wurzburg YA novel that I've spent 20 years searching for, and I was starting to think I dreamed it until I saw it in her book pile. Enjoy. Well, we are in Brooklyn, and I've just seen a New York book, although I've not read this one in particular, but I love Dawn Powell.
Oh, she's the greatest.
Tell me about The Wicked Pavilion.
So she's my all-time favorite. I buy copies of this this book and Lucas Have No King whenever I see them.
That's the one I love.
So, yeah, this one is all set at the Cafe Julian, and all the regulars are there, and they are very drunk all the time and having all kinds of, you know, crazy intrigues and affairs. Yeah, I love everything she does.
Awesome. Which writer do you think writes New York closest to the New York you know? Because I know in your book, St. Mark's is Dead, that's very much about, you know, place and things happening in a place and really sort of rooted to the city.
I think Dawn Powell is still super relevant. Like, I know writers who are just as scheming and as the characters, and just as drunk as the characters in Dawn Powell.
I have to ask you about this book because I don't know it, and what a title, Sexual Customs in Rural Norway.
It is so much more boring than it seems to be, but we tend to leave it out just as a conversation piece. It's very anthropological and not nearly as salacious as you would hope.
Oh, I've just opened a chapter about adulterers. Now it is certainly so that many adulterers thereby escape all punishment, in that the aggrieved spouse often and for many reasons will not bring suit and does not want the punishment carried out. It sounds quite upset that it's not punishable.
Yes, I know. It's a it's a very punitive kind of a book. My family on one side is Norwegian, and so I think it's very accurate.
Oh, here's a bit about eating water porridge 21 times a week. I mean, I think if you were expecting a sexy read.
Yes, no. But it's a great cover.
Oh, this looks fabulous. Attitude, Common Sense Defense for Women by Lisa
Sliwa. So do you know about the Guardian Angels, who were in the 80s? They were patrolling the subways and the streets. It was started by this guy, Curtis Sliwa, and his then-wife did this insane Common Sense Defense book for women, and the pictures are just really remarkable. And he's a model in a lot of it, where she's like, you know, she's kneeing him in the groin, or like, you know, punching his eyes out. There it is.
So just to paint a picture, as we're doing audio, it's very mimey, I think. It looks like something you get at a theatre
school.
Yeah, they're
in theatre blacks, exactly.
Sort of like that spandexy black, mm-hmm. lots of very, they're very kind of acrobatic, they're sort of quite beautiful, quite Lindsay Kempy. Do I mean Lindsay Kemp?
And yeah, she's got the spandex tights with the kind of big socks and little shoes that were very popular in the 80s while she's strangling him with his tie. It's a pretty educational book with headings like bus shelters, boarding psychology, finding a seat, subway windows, reading, avoiding thugs, and rush hour.
Oh, what did she say about avoiding thugs?
On the subway, if you feel someone is checking you out, move to another car.
I could see there being like a sort of a redux of that, and I would absolutely volunteer if you need someone to hold awkward poses.
Yes, I definitely saw them a lot when I was a kid in my neighborhood. So I grew up in the East Village on St. Mark's Place, and it was a much more dangerous time. It's funny, my son is growing up here now, and it's a very different city in a lot of ways. And people complain about it a lot, and I hear those complaints, but also it's, like, so much safer. And sometimes I'm like, you know, put your chain inside your shirt and, like, don't take your wallet out anywhere where anybody can see it. And my son will be like, you know, it's not the 70s. It's like, okay. And I think he is actually correct.
I was just reading Anu Babbitt's essay about time spent in New York coming from L.A. and how she... walking around the 70s, and as a matter of habit, she just like leave her purse open all the time so she'd get to what she needs to get to, and constantly having angry women like accost her and saying, shut your purse, it's not safe.
Yeah, I think that's one thing about New York is like people always have opinions about everything, and like I've definitely been like asked for advice, and then I start to give advice about like, you know, directions, and then somebody else would be like, no, you should take the C, and they'd be like, no, they can't take the C, and you'll have like two or three New Yorkers on the sidewalk like arguing about which advice, you know, which directions to give to this poor tourist who's like, I just want to get to the Met or whatever.
This book, Susanna Callahan, The Great Pretender, I answered, she wrote Brain on Fire. This looks amazing. In 1973, a charismatic doctor convinced 8 healthy people to commit themselves to mental hospitals. They had to prove their sanity to be set free. Their undercover mission would change our understanding of madness forever. So is this a sort of like an historical book?
She tries to find all the patients, the pseudo patients who went into these insane asylums. They didn't have anything necessarily psychologically wrong with them when they went in, and she tried to find them all, and then she runs into all of these blockades trying to find them, and she starts to think maybe this guy made them up, and it becomes this mystery where she's trying to track these people down and trying to figure out, like, did he fabricate this incredibly influential study? And it's just a page turner. It's really exciting. She's a good friend of mine. We run a women's nonfiction reading series and kind of support group once a month at a bar.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. So what are you reading at the moment in the group?
It's not a book club. It's like people do readings. So we'll have we did one with like Susan Orlean, where Susanna and I and our other co-host, Karen Abbott, who's also a great writer, whose book, The Ghosts of Eden Park, just came out. The three of us will interview the person. And we'll have editors come who are looking for pitches. And it's just like a kind of a gang of women journalists.
Oh, what a brilliant thing to do. That sounds fantastic. I would love to come. I can see you on the cover here.
Oh, yeah.
A thrilling eye-opening read, even for those who thought they weren't affected by the psychiatric world. And John Ronson says, it's what you should read after you've read the psychopath test, mm-hmm. which is a heck of a recommendation.
Yeah, it's a terrific book.
Oh,
it's really,
really
exciting.
I read that. I should explain. We are in your Brooklyn apartment, And most of your books are upstate. So very, very kindly you've provided pictures of your upstate books. So we're looking at virtual shelves and real shelves. So there's this book here by Lisa Carver.
Yes.
The font is very curly. So I was like, is that Carver or Gover? Dancing Queen, A Lusty Look at the American Dream. But I know there are lots of her books in.
Yeah, I have. So I've been friends with her. I was her editor back at Nerve.com, which I was an editor at many, many years ago.
So just to explain, because I don't know, I know Nerve had a lot of fans in the UK, but just in case, that was a kind of. I remember
it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, she was basically their star writer in my mind. And just super creative and surprising. And she'd done this zine called Roller Derby for many years. And this book, Dancing Queen, I love. I give it to a lot of people. It's an essay collection about America. And it's so enthusiastic. Like, she just has this approach to the world that's so curious and unusual. I find it very refreshing.
That's amazing. We've got a chapter called A Visit to the Sadistic Beauty Parlor. A place where only girls can go, to the gynecologist. On the Judith Krantz roadmap of love, all hideways lead to trouble. Oh, this looks so good.
She had one essay, I don't know if it's in there or not, but it was about sexualists versus sensualists, and about how she was a sexualist and not a sensualist, and how sensualists made her crazy. It was like, the men, they like have their long hair, and they hang it over you in bed, and it's so horrible and creepy, and they light candles, and it was all of this sort of talk about how terrible sensualists were. And
do you know the writer Marion Keyes? He's an Irish writer. He's really, really funny, like commercially, like so successful, but so she's just. I think she's brilliant, and I think because she's so popular and does so well, people don't always appreciate just how socially brilliant and smart she is. But she has she calls it feathery strokery. But yeah, that kind of, you know, men who are like, I'm just gonna.
Heathery strokery is a great term. That's perfect. Yeah.
It's the same idea with a different name.
Yes. Do you know this book, Chroma? Do you know Derek Jarman, the director? So this is one of my favorite books. I give this to a lot of people too, where he was going blind in the last months of his life, and he wrote a chapter for every color, and it was all of his associations with that color. And when you read it, you start to see the world more vividly,
Wow.
Because you start to appreciate, like, gray or yellow or whatever you're reading that afternoon. It's just a beautiful book about mortality and beauty.
That's an amazing idea for essays, and I like that it's sort of a mix of prose and poetry. It'll be quiet while I read it.
Well, this one is just, it's so unique. It's such a special thing.
And right here, it says New Delhi, India, finished in hospital, March 1995.
Oh, I forgot about that. I forgot I'd written in that. I used to write when I finished books on the, like, author page. So yeah, I took a trip around India when I was 18 by myself. It was sort of a ridiculous thing to do in retrospect, or I wrote to a bunch of places that I knew were doing, like, permaculture or something that I thought was interesting. And then a lot of them wrote me back and invited me to come. And then I got out a map and, like, traced a route for 3 months to go from one to the other. So I started at Mother Teresa's Mission in Calcutta, and then I just went down along the East Coast and up the West Coast. And so, yeah, but I got sick and I wound up in the hospital. I guess I was reading Chroma. Who knew?
That must have been quite an intense read when you were sick and thousands of miles from home.
I guess it was. I mean, it seems appropriate now because he was dying and I almost did. So,
What happened? Was it like a bug?
Like amoebic dysentery.
Oh,
and
my God.
Yeah, it was pretty. Well, I had been working. I started in Bangladesh and I was working at building like sanitary latrines and doing like all this sort of Peace Corps type work. And there was only well water. There was no bottled water. So that one didn't go so well.
Well, I guess that's where if you're, you know, in a hospital full of, like, greys and beiges, you want to, you know, see even the blandest colours more.
Yeah, it's true. And actually, it's funny, this book is called A Treasury of Traditional Wisdom, and I bought this in India. It's this giant book, and it's printed, like a lot of books in India are, on this sort of slightly yellowish paper. The chapters are things like union, identity, and discernment, truth, and combat, action. Mercy, love, contemplation, and it's these categories, and then it's just quotes from the Bible and from the Gita and from, like, all of these different sources of religious inspiration.
Kind of universal and comprehensive.
Yes, East and West, Plato, Muhammad, And all I can think of is, like, in Middlemarch, where he's writing the key to all mythologies. Like, that's basically what this book is.
Wow, I mean, it's such an enormous thing to buy and carry around with you.
It's so fun, though. You can just, like, open it up anywhere and get hit with a lot of really interesting and strange philosophy.
This book, Beautiful Losers by Barbara Wurzbach, it's got the most amazing cover. It looks like classic YA. Oh, ages 12 and up.
It totally is. And so there is this series of books. I have...
Oh my God! What? I love this book! I read this book!
You don't know why! I don't know anybody who's read this book.
I think about this all the time, and I found it in my school library at secondary school. And I'm always like, what the hell was that book I read about the girl who's like, you know,
it's a trilogy.
With the old
Did you know there's three of them? I've got two good friends who both, YA books, and this is definitely the winner because it's this trilogy, and for people who don't know it, it's this girl, and she's very heavy, and so it's a lot about eating and her weight and trying to diet.
I remember because it's a love story.
Yeah, which Fat Love Story is the first one.
Eating disordered preteen, that spoke to me.
Yeah. But then the crazy thing is that she falls in love with this older man. And it just takes a real hard left turn.
Oh, yeah, and he's a cheesecake company salesman.
Oh, I forgot about that, yes. So anyway, the romance goes in directions you would not expect. Like, you would think that she would learn to love herself and the romance would end. But no, it does not end, and it goes on for two more books.
Is that, just getting to this bit now, because also this first bit, I guess with it being the third book in the trilogy, it's almost like, you know, on last week's show or previously in Rita's life, but when she starts sleeping with him and she goes on a and her mum freaking out, as you'd expect your mother to do, but then be like, I must take you to therapy, which I thought was a very sophisticated way of dealing with the problem. God, this is sometimes I've worried that I've dreamed this.
Amazing. No, it's so surprising. I think so many of those books are formulaic, and this one completely dispenses with any formula you've ever known.
I remember her being in a way that I found really kind of reassuring so I guess I've not read this since I was like maybe 11 or 12. But she seemed like very relatedly adult. You know, when you are a kid and people think that you are a certain way and your voice, you know, that you're much more limited than you are. Mm-hmm. And so when did you find this book?
Probably a few years ago. My friend Asia, who she mailed it to me. She mailed me Fat a Love Story, and then I went online and found the other two. Just because we like books that are shocking or surprising, that it makes you think, especially as a writer, like you start to think like, oh, you don't have to have it structured like this. You can do this crazy structure.
Because I love and adore Gigi Bloom. And I think in that way, she's very much, I think in a way that possibly was more typical then than now. I thought she tends to treat her characters in quite a sophisticated way. But they do tend to get happy endings, which is great. The emotional development seems quite steady and quite linear compared to that.
But you can map them. And this one you cannot map. It's all over the place.
I always thought Paula Dessinger, I never know if I'm saying her name right, that she was a little darker and that her characters were just slightly messier.
The other YA books that I like a lot that are also very sexy are Francesca Leah Block's book, Weetie Bat, is one of the big ones.
I don't know.
Oh, she's wonderful. It's very, very Los Angeles. They're all set with like the jacaranda blossoms and the lights and these wild nights out running around, and they're just so mystical. And there's a lot of sex in them.
Oh, that sounds super fun.
They're really good. I read them in my early 20s, and they're transporting in this way.
Did you read that book, The Pisces, by Melissa Broder?
Uh-uh.
Well, it's set in L.A., and it's about a woman who has sex with a merman. And it's got that kind of very West Coast, very sexy, very explicit, also quite mystical. It's that sort of shift of, like, the magical realism, and it's in a real universe, and then it just goes slightly distorted and weird, so...
That sounds a lot like Francesca Leah Block, because there are characters who don't seem fully human in her books, too.
Oh, she's fantastic.
Yeah, she's good. All right, what else did I do? Oh, so our last child's book that I brought is, I was obsessed with these. Did you ever read these books? Like
that?
So it's like the Encyclopedia Brown, which I was also obsessed with, but these Hawkeye Collins and Amy Adams books, they're like, can you solve the mystery? And I would read a dozen of these a week.
That is so evocative. So again, for the listener who might take a photo of this, that's okay. Well,
yeah,
remember. got the case, the clever computer crooks, and this is an amazing sort of, it's a computer that looks like a microwave on a typewriter. And there's a sort of, you know, I guess this poor child is a nerd because he's got very square, like Elvis Costello-y glasses, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
but he has like the girl the pretty, you know, best friend who's a girl, mm-hmm. The way that they always do.
So is this a little bit like a choose your own adventure book?
Yeah, it's like that but there's drawings because he would draw the pictures and you'd have to solve the mystery with the clues that are in the picture and in the story. So I was totally obsessed with those as a kid. So now we can move back to grown-up books. P.G. Wodehouse is one of my favorite writers.
So this is Smith in the City. I always get this mixed up with The Indiscretions of Archie. So Smith in the City is...
I get them all mixed up because they all have almost the same names and some of them have more than one. It's like, so Right Ho Jeeves is one of my favorites, I think. But then I can't remember if that's, you know, the one where, like, which is the one with the pig? Which is the one with, you know, but I just love everything.
Something that comes up a lot is everyone can remember the way a book made them feel, but sometimes you're like, I couldn't tell you what happened, I just remember.
Yes.
And I think that in the loveliest, best way, that consistency of you know his universe, and it's such a nice feeling to be it. So,
and the characters and the names, like Gussie Finknottle, who's an inebriated newt fancier, but the Bertie Wooster... Jeeves ones are that we listen to those audiobooks in the car a lot in my family, and they're so satisfying because the actor playing Jeeves is always so dry and deadpan. But oh, and Stephen Fry does the Sherlock Holmes audiobook that is like 80 hours of pure delight.
So this is something that you listen to as a family?
Yes, on car trips, and my son loves all things British, so we indulge that with P.G. Wodehouse and Sherlock Holmes.
Is there anything that you have discovered through your son in that world of kind of, you know, old detective novels and old sort of human, did you introduce him to a lot of this stuff, or has he brought any of it into your world?
Well, I mean, I think just audiobooks in general, I had never really done them, but then he got a tape player and a bunch of Harry Potter cassettes, and he would, this is when he was like 5 or 6 years old, and he would just do the Harry Potter cassettes while doing Legos, and so it would just be the constant sound, and he would just, you know, every time they ended, he would just stand up, flip it over, keep playing it, and then keep doing Legos. He could do it for infinite numbers of hours. So then we started to realize that the tapes wore out. We're like, oh, we can just get this online, and then you don't even have to get up from your Legos. So we started doing that, and then I started listening to, The Woman in White. I did that as an audiobook.
That Wilkie Collins.
Yes. It's so trashy.
I get it really confused with The Woman in Black, which The Woman in Black is spooky.
This is spooky too. There's like the woman, she appears on the road, and it's very classic gothic horror.
I wonder if that's... Do you think it's more fun to listen to it than to read it, to really get that atmosphere of being...
I don't know. I go back and forth. I usually have a couple books I'm listening to and then a couple books I'm reading at least. So I just like having all of the different sources.
What do you listen to at the moment? And where do you listen? Is it on the go or do you put it on?
On the subway. I just finished Middlemarch, which I hadn't read in years. And I thought like, I had a long car trip that I had to take. So and I was like, it's 50 hours or whatever. So I can do that. And I was sad when it ended. It was so nice to live with.
Was it a different experience coming back to it now?
Yeah, I think I read it when I was a teenager last time, and it's so much more interesting now. I feel like I got so much more out of it in terms of the decisions you make and the kind of men that are this way or that way, and the moral choice that she makes with the will. I don't, just all of it, it resonated more.
I think that's so interesting that some of those, especially with classic books, but all the books that you come to, and you're, I think that when one is a sort of, you know, teenager or whatever, you've got such a clear sense of like, well, of course, that's exactly what you should do. Why would you do anything else? And then you realize how, you know, it's hard being an adult.
And I think it's a problem too with being like a precocious child or teenager. It's like, I read a lot of classic books when I was 12, 13, 14, 15, you know, like, and then I'm like, oh, I read that. But like, did I, you know, I didn't absorb it as an adult. So I'm trying to go back and read a lot of
words,
those now.
But...
Yeah, I knew the words and I got the story. But it's you have a different perspective on things as a grown-up.
Can you remember the first time you read a book growing up when you thought, oh my goodness, this is for me. This is for no one but me. This is my book.
I think Jane Eyre. I read that when I was really very young, and so I felt kind of like I was happy to be seen carrying it around because I think I was probably 13 or something. And I found it so, like, I guess sexy, like, and so mysterious. And I think I really related to her because I also was this sort of, like, good girl and responsible with this rich fantasy life.
I guess, in a way, I think the Brontes, it's the opposite of that, because I think everything that they write about is so intense and extreme. And it's almost like, I mean, obviously, you know, I mean, I absolutely love a great YA, as we discussed, but I think something like Jane Eyre has almost that YA vibe of a universe sort of absolute kind of moral truths and imperatives and everybody really knowing their emotions and feeling them.
Yeah, and I think also, like Jane Austen, where everything is so ratcheted up. Like, if you show an ankle, if you exchange a look, it's so dense with meaning. And I think if you're young, especially, that's very satisfying because your threshold for excitement is pretty low still, where you're like, oh yes, it is thrilling if he looks at me in class.
I think it might be in Emma, maybe, when possibly Frank Churchill tries to make love to, oh God, I can't even remember if it's Emma or Harriet. And I think, you know, that obviously just means there's a language of the times that tried to, you know, kiss her or something,
right.
Or just even like say lots of nice things to her.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, they had sex with the cat, that's so racy.
Yes, exactly.
What I love about Jane Austen, I think, is the bitchiness of it.
Yeah.
And that it was absolutely, as soon as I realised, like, oh my God, this is just like, you know, before, like, Mean Girls, capital M, capital G,
yes.
Like, you know, sort of, I'm at school with these girls,
yes.
But in, you know, it's a different context, but people, we've not changed that much, and
you
we never will.
What is that line? I just remember Greer Garson saying it in the movie of, like, where she's practicing archery, and she delivers this line to the girl who's trying to snub her that's like, I hope next time the arrow hits its mark, or something like that. It's just these really saucy comebacks.
What is this bit of sob sister?
Oh, yeah, that's what we named the nonfiction group that I run after. So sob sister was a name for women journalists in the 1930s because they were the ones who wrote these stories that made people cry because they were tear jerkers and... So we reclaimed this rather diminutive title for our group of women writers.
I didn't know about any of this. This is a beautiful edition. I love, you got it from A Books, I see. And it's by Mildred Gilman, which is a very...
Yeah, and she was a writer for The New Yorker. I went back and read a lot of her journalism. It's very good. It was from the 30s, and she covered a lot of crimes and a lot of New York City happenings, but this novel it draws heavily from her time on a city desk. And I worked on a city desk at the New York Post for a little while, about 10 years ago.
Jeez, I'd rather work on a story with 10 men reporters than one female sob sister, female sister as well. So, I was just rereading Nora Ephron's essay about working on the Post and the editor,
yes.
And her campaign to get the toilets cleaned and stuff, and how
right, she was the only one using the women's bathroom, right?
So, did you say you worked on the city desk?
Mm-hmm.
What was that like? Were you?
It was fascinating. It was really. It was good for me in that I had worked at New York Magazine and all these other places where I was writing about culture. And so when you call people, they wanted to talk to you. And they did not want to talk to you when you called from the Post after a tragedy had happened. So I got a lot of practice trying to get people to let me interview them and being shot down a lot, which just made me much better as a reporter. And I wish I'd had that experience earlier.
I'm trying to kind of picture how it would be that you'd sort of have, you know, things to, you know, some would say, like, here's a list of people to call, here's a...
So one time I arrived at work and the editor on the desk said, it's a wonderful day. And I was like, why? And he said, oh, overnight, this Russian spy was arrested. And I said, okay, great. Like, what's her name? What am I doing? And he's like, oh, it's more wonderful than you could even imagine because look at her picture. And she's beautiful. And I'm like, oh, great. Like, there's the cover. And then he's like, Ada, look at the color of her hair. And I was like, oh, it's red. Of course. Now you've got like 20 headlines. He's like, this is 3 weeks of headlines. So it's things like that. I wound up doing a lot of online research trying to track that information to help figure out where people were going to be sent to Door Knock, because a lot of the reporters who'd been there a long time, they were sort of the boot leather school, and they didn't trust the internet particularly. So I was one who like, if there was a hurricane and they needed to go interview people whose windows had blown in, I would go on Twitter and be like, oh no, my windows just blew in, like as a search, and then find people who were tweeting about or talking about online and be like, here's some leads, why don't we call these 10 people, because it seems like they all got hit, and then you can figure out who to go to. I would find things because I just got all these hunches. For like, there was that Times Square bomber when I was there, and nobody had a picture of him. We need a picture of him. So I started looking around online, and then it took me a few hours, but then I found on MySpace, his brother-in-law had posted the bomber's wedding pictures, like 10 years earlier when he was in high school. And he was like, oh, here's my new, you know, brother-in-law. So I really enjoyed it as a kind of a treasure hunt.
It's weird, isn't it? Because nearly all the journalism I've done has been when I worked for a teen mag, so lots of it was like, oh, go and interview like this band or whatever. You know, they knew you were coming. There was no doing it. But one of the things I had to do was, it was like a real life section. So, you know, getting teenagers where it's like things have happened. And that in being aware of those real like ambulance chasing agencies where, oh my God, there was one story that was all, and because we had just no budget and no money, and we always had to kind of do it like a year after everyone else, or this poor kid was at, I think maybe Glastonbury, and she was in like a porta potty, and it rolled down a hill.
Oh, no.
And everybody was like, this poor, she was known as like Poo Girl in the UK press, and I just remember like Edith saying like, please try and get me Poo Girl. She's a teenager, come on. She's like, this is our demographic. I don't think I did in the end. I think we got close, but she was like, we can give her like a goodie bag of like tiny bottles of shampoo. Sugar can give her £1,000. She's going to go with sugar.
Oh, wow.
I keep thinking as well about what Nora Ephron said with having to, I'm sure it was different when you were there, but like you had to, I think the phone bit and the headset were separate and nothing ever matched. And there were never quite like enough of one thing to go with the other. So you had to like lock your headset in your drawer when you went to lunch. Otherwise someone else would nick it and you'd be there. I'd be like, I can't call anyone. That's, I've got no stories.
Funny. She has this essay collection that I have. It's called like Scribble Scribble. Yes. It's a great title.
I love that so much. It's a real masterclass. The other thing I think about constantly is her piece about the, I think it's called the Ladies Palm Beach Home Journal or something.
Yes. Oh, totally. It's a great piece.
All of these sort of like fabulous, wealthy women of a certain age in caftans. Again, all bitching about each other. Yes. Jane Austen style, but in print.
Yes, exactly. No, she's wonderful.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
We'll be back to Ada soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week, a story so valuable that Indiana Jones himself would go on a crusade for it. This week it's Old Filth by Jane Gardam, a story of Edward Feathers, the Raj orphan who survives intolerable cruelty and confusion growing up to become a wealthy, celebrated QC. Gardam is an extraordinarily gifted writer of prose. Every single one of her characters sings with vulnerability and humanity. This is a touching, quietly devastating, funny and overwhelmingly evocative book. It made me feel enormously privileged to have spent time with everyone I met on its pages. Old Filth is published by Abacus and it's out now. Now back to Ada. So here we have John by Annie Baker.
Oh, I love. So she is a playwright and she everything she does, I try to go see. I have a good friend who works at the Times who writes about comedy mostly, but he also gets theater tickets and he takes me a lot. And he turned me on to her and I think she's a genius. So I saw the play and then I think I bought it because I wanted my husband to read it. And then I reread it too because it's I love reading plays. I've seen, the Flick, that one, like the Pulitzer or some big prize.
Oh, wow.
And that's also a wonderful play that I wound up having to read because I missed the production of it. But it's all set at a movie theater and it's all the people working at the movie theater sweeping up the popcorn.
Oh, and I don't really, for shame, and I should do, I when I was a teenager, I used to read plays a lot. And now I never think to do it. And
it's very satisfying too because it's so fast. Mm. You can read it in a couple hours. I just picked this up. I was doing a bookstore event, and I always try to just buy a couple hardcovers whenever I do anything. And so this was on the. Well, I mean, I love bookstores, and I want them to prosper. So I grabbed this from the front table because it was under the recommended, and it's Warlight by Michael Ondaatje, and I don't read a lot of new novels, but it's so good. It's just very beautifully written. It's set in World War II in London, and it's told from the point of view of these children, or this one child, and then he's talking about his sister, and his parents abandon them, and they're living with this guy who's a little shady. It's really lovely.
Great. That's such an evocative cover as well.
Yeah, it's like beautiful. The street light.
Man rising out of the mist.
Yeah. And I didn't read The English Patient, so this is actually my first book by him, and I'm like, oh, that's what the fuss is about. I get it.
I've never read The English Patient. It's one of it when it's so much part of the culture, you think you know it, and you're like, people probably like that for a reason. I should probably go. The Decay of Lying by Oscar Wilde.
Oh, yeah. Ooh, so when I was young, Oscar Wilde and P.G. Woodhouse were my two favorites. They were really what gave me a sense of what humor was like in writing and how creative you could be with the way you structured sentences and the directions you took things. So, but yeah, this is this cute little green book. I don't even remember where I got it.
It was $2.99. in Penguin. It says here, it's got your name on, and it says 2010. So I don't know if that's when
I finished.
It doesn't say where or any other. Huh. Why does it say that? Am I going mad? Oh, here we go.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, that might. So I read it in the 90s. This is NM, that's my husband. He started whenever I had that in there and he read my books. He would write his own.
Oh, that's
name in there.
Lovely.
Yeah.
What books has he introduced you to, if any? Are there anything that you
I'm trying to think. So he reads a lot of religious books, a lot of mysticism. Ooh. And so like St. Teresa of Avila he gave me and that's his main thing. And then country music. I think not as much many books because he got a terrible education and he grew up in East Texas, but he's educated me thoroughly in country music.
Well, I think that's sometimes really nice. You know, you can bring different things to each other and then have because, it's great to have books in common with people and to like the same thing, but then you do end up with a lot of overlap. Was that something really great I saw about someone developing a horrible habit of truth telling? It's so great.
Well, if I remember correctly, I think this was to his sons, right? Vivian and the other one. And it was all
Cyril,
about...
which I'm only saying because it's on the page I opened it at. Otherwise, yeah. I wouldn't know.
And he is telling them basically that nature is flawed and that making things up is way better. And there's something, having grown up in the city and growing up in this cosmopolitan world that I really appreciated about this idea that there's something beautiful about falsehood and fabrication and urbanity.
And I guess, now more than ever, everything is distorted by the way someone else is seeing it, really. When you really, really think about it, truth is not objective, which kind of brings us back to mysticism, I guess. and here we have American Predator, The Hunt for the Most Particular Serial Killer of the 21st Century by Maureen Callahan.
Moderated a talk with her. So she actually worked at the New York Post too. So Susanna Cahalan and Maureen and I have all, we are all blonde and all worked at the Post at various times.
And there's Susanna on the back of this.
Yes, I'm in here too. We all just blurb each other's books. I know it's a racket, right? It's like...
I love it, good love roll.
But it's sincere.
Wow, you've got the big one. Yeah. On the
It's a great, if you like serial killer books, this is an amazing one. She spent years doing it, and she had to sue to get all these files, and it's totally terrifying and very well done.
Do you like a lot of kind of true crime books?
Occasionally. I've read only a few. I'm very susceptible and very sensitive, so I can't read them all the time.
I know what you mean. I don't like that murderers exist. But every so often I will read something and be absolutely blown away by how brilliantly it's done and how sort of compelling and fascinating it is. But I think I've maybe got 3 or 4 in me a year tops before that's the most murderous I can handle.
It's like riding roller coasters, which I also like to do once every couple of years. It just kind of clears the cobwebs out. Not every day.
Getting extremely drunk. I'm now at the point in my life where I'm like, that's a twice a year activity for me. Should we have a look at some virtual books?
So one is that I just saw in these pictures was Night of the Gun, the David Carr book. He was a longtime New York Times writer, and he mentored a lot of people. And he died not that long ago, a few years ago. And then all of these stories poured out from almost all of my friends saying, he wrote me the most encouraging, amazing letter about how I, you know, and I was like, oh, it's so sweet. But then I was also like, why didn't I get it? But this book,
he probably was like, you know, Ada is great. Ada doesn't need any help. She's doing absolutely fine.
But he was just a really incredible guy. So Night of the Gun is this story where he actually goes back and reports on his own life. So he had all these drug and alcohol problems and had been involved in crimes and had just been quite a bad person, as even when he had these twin babies. And he told a story about having left them in the car when he went in to score drugs and left them out there for hours. And it's just amazingly well done because he brings all of his reporting experience to bear on this memoir. And as a memoirist, I think it's just so inspiring hard he worked.
That sounds great. Is he quite kind of judgmental of himself, or does he sort of present it as fact, or is there a combination of two?
He's trying very hard, I think, to be clear-eyed and to hold his feet to the fire and to try to go back and figure out what he can know for sure about what he did and to try to make up for it a little bit, at least in terms of acknowledging it. And the reason it's called The Night of the Gun is he had this memory of the story where his friend's like waving a gun around. I think this is how it goes. And then he goes back to be like, oh, remember when you had that gun? And they were like, no, you had the gun.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
It's very, very well written. So every time I teach anything involving memoir, I always have people read that book.
In the UK, I think Will Self's memoir has just come out.
I read a review of that was really
scathing. But that almost sounds like the opposite. You know, sort of that could be perhaps the antidote.
I think that's right. I think, what I love about it is that he really is not trying to justify anything. He's not trying to make himself look great. In fact, he looks quite bad in the book. But then in doing that, you just get a sense of him as being ashamed and trying to make it better. I love that book.
That sounds really, really compelling. I would love to read that.
Yeah, it's highly recommended.
So here I see Colette. I see A Flatland Fable.
Oh, yeah, I love this book, The Flatland Fable. And that was one of those books. I go to used bookstores all the time. And at one, I just like the cover. It's a picture of a farm in the middle of nowhere. So I picked it up, and I loved it. It's by this guy, Joe Coomer. I read a few of his books now, and I liked all of them. He and Lou Shiner I found at the same time. Do you know him? He has a book called Glimpses, and another book called Slam. And Glimpses is amazing.
Oh, Slam, I think I've heard of.
Yeah, it's a skateboarding in Austin novel. But this Joe Coomer book, it's just so small. It's like, I think it's a day or a few days in the life of this family in the Midwest. And it's just beautiful.
Agency reminds me. I really love books where it's a very specific sort of time. What I want is like the opposite of a saga.
Oh, yes, exactly.
48 hours.
I was just hearing somebody on a podcast, I think, talking about the books that have everything in them. Oh, it was the Salman Rushdie interview on The Literary Life. And he was saying like there should just be two categories of books, like the quiet little books where like very few things happen and then the books where everything happens.
It's true. I love a quiet little book. Did you read Quichotte?
I haven't yet. Did you read it?
I did. And it was much more fun than I thought it was going to be. It's very, a little bit, I think, self-referential. And you could almost hear, oh, it's a really good book. This is very clever here. But there's a woman in it called Salma, who's, I guess, kind of a little bit Kim Kardashian-esque. She's sort of a huge Bollywood star. He becomes a sort of neo Oprah, and I think he writes her really well. I was really impressed by how it was like, oh, he managed to write a woman convincingly. Yeah. Hooray! Because not everyone does.
Indeed.
Oh, I love Olivia Lang.
The one I reviewed, this is The Lonely City, I reviewed for The Times, and I really loved.
I love that book. On the picture, you can just see the lonely bit. And then, I think The Lonely City. Oh, there we go. It's the that's the end of the
show.
There
it is, yeah.
Because you sort of think it's going to be a memoir, and then it's almost an anti-memoir. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's sort of losing itself in other people's lives. And because we just went to see, me and producer Dale, the David Wojnarowicz exhibition.
Oh,
I'm looking at producer Dale for confirmation because I can never say his last name right.
You did it right. That's wonderful. Yay!
There was an exhibition of his work at the Reina Sofía in Madrid. And we had to go to Madrid because it wasn't coming to the UK.
Amazing.
But it was really great. And then interesting as well because we just went to the Guggenheim and saw, they had like a sort of a mini Basquiat bit at the top. We saw how sort of the posters and things that David Wojnarowicz made.
Uh-huh.
But it was a real kind of moment of like, everything is connected.
Yeah. No, I, a friend of mine has a big David Wojnarowicz poster in his kitchen. It's the one where he's a boy. It's like the picture of the boy, and it's all these things about the boy written around it. This is my friend Gilbert King. This is his latest book. It's called Beneath a Ruthless Sun. So he does these incredible books where he winds up reinvestigating murder cases and death row cases, and he's exonerated people, and it's he's a really good person, and he's won the Pulitzer I don't even know how many times.
Yeah, I have a lot of friends who'd like to find out about murderers. But I guess these are all people who are falsely accused
he does these Devil in the Grove, that was his famous book about this corrupt prosecutor in Florida, and he's just really a remarkable writer and researcher. Barbara Ehrenreich. Mm. Oh, that's it. I love that book, Nickel and Dimed, where she went and tried to make a living as a maid at a hotel. Barbara Ehrenreich has written about social justice for many years, but she actually just went, and I can't remember how long, was it 6 months or something, or a year, where she tried to live off of minimum wage, and she wrote about what it was like. And it was just brutal. She really learned so much about the on-the-ground reality of being incredibly poor in America, and it's a very well-done book. Oh, I have all these weird books that were set in the East Village through the years. So this one, The Season of the Witch by James Leo Herlihy, that's from the 70s, and it's there's kidnapping, and it's all these beatniks who are behaving very badly, and I guess hippies who are behaving badly. This is Sarah Heppala. She's an old friend of mine.
Oh,
that's her
I
book,
love
Blackout.
That book, Blackout. I think that's fantastic.
She's great. And actually, she has some of the best quotes, I think, in my new book that's coming out in January. But she and I worked together at the Austin Chronicle a million years ago, like when we were very, very young.
Does she write about that time in that book? I vaguely remember.
She does, yes.
Coming up.
Yeah.
Because I think it's interesting how, I think that, you know, compared with lots of kind of addiction memoirs that I've read, because I love an addiction memoir, mm-hmm. and the way she really, it's one of the most emotionally vulnerable sort mm-hmm. of books I've read about the subject, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, what is that, the sports writer by?
Oh, that's the Richard Ford book.
I love those vintage editions.
Me too.
I've got all the Jane McInerney ones.
They're so lovely. Those and like, was it the Vintage International? Those, I have all those ones. So but the sports writer is like a classic middle-aged man, midlife crisis book. And so I feel like I tried to read a lot of those when I was working on my midlife crisis for women book.
Which, can we talk more about this?
Oh, sure.
About the new book?
Yeah.
So it's called Why We Can't Sleep,
Women's New Midlife Crisis, and it comes out in January.
And is it essays again, or is it a continuous?
No, it's a study. So I did this article for Oprah.com that a couple years ago that went super viral, and it was basically about Generation X women and how nobody pays any attention to us. And in fact, what we're trying to do is very difficult, and culturally, we just hit all these different roadblocks when we were coming out of college trying to get jobs. There was the jobless recession, and when we were basically like at every stage economically, we've been in a bad way. And so now we're trying to like usually have little kids and full-time jobs and taking care of aging parents while going through perimenopause, and then the culture is telling us to like lean in. So it's just about that, and I interviewed hundreds of women for the book. There's a little bit of memoir in it, but mostly it's just trying to describe this generation of women and what's different in middle age for us than was for our mothers and grandmothers.
I think that's such an interesting subject. I'm so excited about reading it.
Thank
I'm
you, Dave.
Desperate to get my hands on that. You've not got a Word document. No.
Yeah, of course. You can do whatever you want.
Are there any books that you kind of found when you were writing it that were sort of useful or helpful or insightful, either like fiction or...
Well, one thing I think people don't talk about is menopause and perimenopause. So I feel like all the books that talked in any way realistically about those topics, I found really helpful and fascinating. There's one that's like Menopause Confidential, and that was actually really good. But yeah, but there weren't a lot. I mean, I think one thing that was interesting to me is that women who are having a midlife crisis tend to downplay it. They tend to say, oh, I'm lucky, everything's fine, it's not so bad. And that actually, when you look at their lives, they're quite bad. They're quite hard. So what's interesting to me is all the middle-aged men books where they're very indulgent of all their feelings and their needs and their like desire to break free. And
when you hear about a midlife crisis, the assumption, it always sounds quite male and quite flashy,
yeah,
and quite like,
and
yeah,
get a girlfriend and yeah.
You so rarely, I think. I very rarely hear women refer to it in that sense, where it's like, well, yeah, of course, you're going to hit the midpoint.
And
do you know a book called Out of Time by a writer called Miranda Sawyer, who's a
British journalist? Oh, yes, I read that. Yes, that was really good.
I really, really liked that book.
I liked it a lot, too.
What, there's there a Martin Amis, I always got my Amis's confused, I think it's Martin Amis, about the sort of aging and the way we look back and look forward, and then... the sort of, you know, that not looking forward becomes a full-time occupation, or it's not looking back, but that's sort of this idea of
having to comprehend
that life is finite at this point and not really knowing which direction to face.
Well, and I think there's all these analogies, like if you're on the top of the hill, then it's downhill after that, and but once you're on that perch in middle age, you can look back on your life more clearly and forward at your life more clearly. And so if you have regrets for things you did or didn't do, you have to live with them and wrestle with them at that moment. And then if you have ideas for things you want to do or you feel like you're no longer able to do looking forward, you also have to grapple with those. But it's funny, women I wanted to interview, I would say, do you think I could talk to you for this book? And they would say, oh, I'm not having a midlife crisis. And they're like, I mean, unless you think that, like, you know, my husband leaving me after taking all our money and having our house foreclosed upon, and then me having an aneurysm and then getting fired from my STEM job, would that count? And I'm like, I think that counts. You know, it's just this overload in midlife of all of these difficult things, but then women tending to minimize them or to say, I have no right to complain. And I beg to differ. I think there is a reason to complain.
I really like something that Brené Brown said, that she was talking to a friend, and I think that where she was in Texas, there was a huge storm and like the power was out for a week, and her friend called to sort of say like, how are you coping? She's like, oh, you know, well, it could be so much worse, because, you know, some people like lost everything and we're just like, you know, we have no power, but it's fine, and like the kids are okay. And her friend said, look, it's me. You don't have to pretend. It's all okay. You can say that you're really pissed off that you have no electricity and you've not had hot water for a week.
Right. And I think eventually you do want to get to the place where you can have gratitude and all these things, but I think there's an intermediate step of actually looking at things as they are. And that's one thing I hope the book does, is say, like, this is actually, these are all the cards stacked against us, and here's why it's like that, and maybe it's not 100% that we didn't work hard enough, because I think a lot of women just think, like, oh, if I just had tried harder, if I did more Pilates, or if I, you know, did this.
Well, that's the trouble with Lean In, I found.
Yes.
You know, with all due respect to Sheryl Sandberg, I'm like, yeah, this is not new information. We have been told the problem was us the whole time. Surely it's not us. Like, be more, be harder, yeah, do better, be quieter.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And there's some amazing study about that book and about writing like it, where people think then if they, the more they read that material, the more they blame women for not getting ahead.
Yeah.
Because it seems as though, oh, if you had only done these things and known your value and
you tried asking for a raise.
Yeah. Get back in there. Yeah. Let's see what else we got.
Wasn't sure if you had a pause.
I've got a lot of Lego books on my shelves because of my son.
Oh, I like the Lego Ideas book.
Oh, it's very good. Yeah, there are a lot of amazing ones. Oh, do you know this book by Abby Fracht called Licorice?
Oh, that does ring a vague bell.
I read it in the 90s. It was some guy I had this mad crush on in high school was reading it, and I was like, I'm going to go read that book. And it's another one of these very small books. It's very quiet. I think it's just like a summer, and she's pregnant, and she's just eating licorice compulsively, and having sexual fantasies, and it's so lovely, and it's like a very quiet book, but I've reread it many times.
Oh, for a quiet book section.
Yes,
excellent.
For the things where the section where nothing happens, the opposite of the Salman Rushdie. Oh, Marilyn Robinson is probably my favorite novelist. So I have a lot of her. I give Housekeeping to a lot of people.
Tell me about Housekeeping.
It's another quiet book, but it's about these sisters and their aunt, and it's about longing and the idea of home and relationships between women, and it's just the most beautifully written thing in the world. Oh, this is my, speaking of women.
Yes. I saw this when you sent the pictures over, and I wanted to, it's Dolly, My Life and Other Unfinished Business. Oh my God, okay. Her hair. I mean, I know, always Dolly, the hair.
So on this book, I share with an editor at Penguin named Trish Bichkowski, and because Tim Gunn, when I was working on a book with him for Trish, Tim was with Dolly Parton and had her sign a book to us. So it's to Ada and Trish. From Dolly Parton.
Oh.
And so we mail it every like 6 months to a year. We trade ownership of the book. So actually I think I'm due to mail this back to her.
Oh, that is the loveliest thing I ever heard. That's so nice.
Joint ownership, joint
Do
custody.
You make sure you read it again when you've got it in your possession?
I will flip through it often. It's probably my favorite celebrity memoir because she talks a lot about these moments in her life where she either felt this really strong connection to music or to God or to her sexuality or to like, or the way she dressed evolved, how she wanted to look like the town tramp because she thought the town tramp was so glamorous. And I think it's a very well done memoir.
I think a lot about Dolly Parton when people are being very scornful about, you know, the Kardashians and this, that, you know, mm-hmm. now in this sort of time of like women are like, it's terrible because they're getting their faces injected full of poison and they're doing this mad contour. And that actually, it's complicated, I think, because on the one hand, no one should be trying to kind of meet a standard they feel they can never meet and using it to make them miserable. But then I think, you know, it's great. Like, women have agency over their own faces. And it's so interesting that we're like, oh, selfies, it's terrible because, like, women are so vain. But like, no, it's the female gaze. It's wonderful. And I think Dolly was a real pioneer in that respect.
I think you're right. And in her case, I think what's so incredible is that it goes along, the way she looks, this unbelievable, sparkly, glowy thing, goes along with like the most beautiful voice of all time and this incredible business savvy on this just deep goodness and kindness. So I think she's a saint. I think she's absolutely amazing. And she has the best quotes. She talks about like, it costs a lot of money to look this cheap. That's one of her lines. And then she also talks about being underestimated. Like there's this line, Do you know all these jokes, these Dolly Parton jokes? There's so many of them, but there's one that's like, you know, people said, oh, do you mind all the dumb blonde jokes? And she said, no, because I know I'm not dumb and I know I'm not blonde.
Huge thanks to Ada. You can follow her at Ada Calhoun on social media. Why We Can't Sleep is out on the 5th of March. It's smart, thoughtful, provocative, and fiercely feminist, and I think you're going to love it. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow shelf obsessives. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyBee. Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. It's produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with this from John Green. Books are the ultimate dumpies. Put them down, and they'll wait for you forever. Pay attention to them, and they always love you back. See you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.